Hello, and welcome to the November edition of the JS Unplugged podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Stephanie Pierce, pediatric sports orthopedic surgeon at the Children's Hospital of the King's Daughters in Norfolk and Virginia Beach, Virginia. This month, orthopedic applications are submitted, and the AOA Cord Universal Offer Day is today, November 15th. In honor of this important time of year for programs, applicants, and the field of orthopedics, we delve into a few topics pertinent for applicants, programs, and mentors alike. These include the orthopedic match, defining the academic profile of successful candidates. We will also explore an article from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons blog, Sounds from the Training Room, regarding Menteeship 101, How Can I Be a Great Mentee? And then we conclude with a great mentorship duo with Dr. Kyle Sweeney and his resident Dr. Douglas Hasse, as we cover their article on transuxemic acid in patients with cancer undergoing endoprosthetic reconstruction, a cost analysis. Let's jump right in. This podcast is brought to you by Modernizing Medicine, helping orthopedic practices fight burnout and connect with patients. Modernizing Medicine offers an orthopedic-specific suite of healthcare IT solutions, including the number one ortho-specific EHR system, EMA, practice management, billing services, analytics, patient engagement tools like telehealth, and more. To see a two-minute demo, visit modmed.com/orthopod. Our summary article this month is a research article titled The Orthopedic Match, Defining the Academic Profile of Successful Candidates. This is by Dr. Yvonne Rasko and colleagues. Orthopedic surgery continues to be one of the most competitive specialties in the residency match. In fact, a quarter failed to match in 2018. With the change of the grading system for USMLE Step 1 from numeric scoring to pass-fail method, other objective metrics, such as publication record, may become more and more important as programs are trying to delineate what makes differences between applicants. This article reviewed the 2014 to 2018 academic years, corresponding to the 2013 to 2017 application cycles, to determine the accurate amount of publications for matched applicants and the trend over the years. This mostly stemmed from the NRMP, or the National Residency Match Program, providing self-reported, descriptive data on research achievements from the applicants. These, unfortunately, can be fairly biased and filled with over-reporting as presentations, posters, and publications, as well as abstracts, are all lumped together. This article is focused to properly inform applicants and those who counsel applicants on what is realistic. The group looked at almost 3,200 matched applicants in orthopedic surgery and collected the following: H-index of each of the applicants, as well as total number of research publications, number of first authored publications, number of orthopedic-focused articles, number of preclinical studies, number of clinical research articles, number of literature reviews, number of systematic reviews and meta-analyses, number of short reports, number of book chapters, and number of editorials. They performed a bibliometric analysis of the applicants using Scopus, PubMed, and Google Scholar. They found that greater than 35% of matched applicants graduated from a top 40 NIH-ranked medical school, and the average number of articles published was 2.6 articles plus or minus 6.6 at the time of application. With this large spread, they also reported the median values, which was one published article per applicant at the time of application, and the median H-index was zero. The average candidate first authored about 28% of their articles. Most publications, about 70%, were orthopedic-related. Clinical research was by far the most common subtype of article choice, and book chapters were the least common. They also saw increasing publications in subsequent years, which resonates with the well-known statement that every year the applicant pool escalates and is more competitive. Overall, the publication count held by successful applicants is substantially lower than the NRMP reported average. Successfully matched orthopedic candidates have increasingly impressive research achievements each cycle, but with that, an average of approximately one peer-reviewed publication has been seen. As publication volume increases, the role and responsibility in the paper decreases. In fact, only 1 in 4 applicants have first authored an article. And finally, matched applicants seem to be shifting research interests towards projects that are faster to publish. This paper gives us more accurate data for both the applicants as well as mentors to guide applicants on what is realistic in pursuing the orthopedic match and making it a little more accessible to more applicants despite the competitive nature overall. Our next article is actually from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons blog, Sounds from the Training Room. It's powered by the JAOS Mentorship Consortium. This article is titled Menteeship 101, How Can I Be a Great Mentee? Authors Matthew Varicolo and Amitabh Iyer. This was from the July 8, 2021 edition, but is a great topic that coordinated well with the November application cycle. I encourage all the listeners to visit the Sounds from the Training Room blog page, as these articles are short but extremely well written and full of great knowledge and information. This one starts out, "Here I am, ready for you to mentor me." So what are some of the great tips that are available for how to be a great mentee? The first is doing your homework ahead of time. It's important to learn about your mentor ahead of time, whether it's from your initial email, phone conversation, face-to-face meeting. Demonstrating that you have an invested interest will go a long way to ensure your success with that relationship. This can take you as few as 10 to 15 minutes on a weeknight, but the benefits will be immeasurable. Number 2, value the encounters and value each other's time. So it's important to respect your time and your mentor's time. Prior to each meeting, create a list of what you want to accomplish. Creating these rank order lists are really important, whether it's a structured mentorship encounter or if it's more of an informal meeting. Having these priorities on your mind and ready to go help advance what you can gain out of the relationship from both sides. Even if you don't tackle all of the topics on the rank list, you can at least have the higher priorities 1 and 2 potentially accomplished in a quick meeting, and then have the remainder of the list to revisit in future meetings with your mentor. Number 3, be proactive. Being proactive is very important in any experience, but especially in a mentorship-mentee relationship. Instead of just saying, "What research projects do you have for me?" changing this and spending time with the mentor in clinic or shadowing, coming and helping, noticing what projects the mentor is engaged in, and then offering help for a specific project that is of interest to the mentee can go an immeasurable amount further. Number 4, remembering the two-way street at all times. It's important for this relationship to be beneficial for both parties. When both people can get benefit out of the relationship, they're more willing to put more into it. So making sure that you are patient. The first time that you meet someone, it's not always going to be the ultimate connection, but delving in and trying to develop how you can help the mentor as well as how the mentor can help you will make that relationship stronger and better and last a lot longer in that time period as well. Number 5, appreciate the dynamic evolution of the relationship. The mentor-mentee relationship is anything but stagnant. And so even in the first meeting, it may feel as though the relationship may be headed in one direction. And as time goes on, it may blossom into even more deeper, meaningful relationships and bonding. More opportunities can arise. And so making sure that you are available to appreciate that dynamic evolution and change and adapt with how relationships expand is important for both you, the mentee, and the mentor. Overall, there is no definitive blueprint for the mentor-mentee relationship, and that's part of the beauty of the relationship. Learn from your experiences, be open-minded, and always be respectful and grateful for each other's time. Good luck. Welcome to the interview portion with Dr. Hasi and Dr. Sweeney going through their article, Transeccemic Acid in Patients with Cancer Undergoing Endoprosthetic Reconstruction, a Cost Analysis. Welcome, Dr. Sweeney and Dr. Hasi. Please introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little bit about you and why you guys decided to pursue this topic.
I'm Kyle Sweeney. I'm a faculty at the University of Kansas Department of Orthopedic Surgery, and this has been kind of an interest of mine for a while, but I'll let Dr. Hasi introduce himself.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Sweeney. I'm Dr. Hosse. I'm a PGY5 at the University of Kansas Medical Center. And he kind of invited me to start pursuing this topic early on in my career. And it's something that has really taken an interest in my kind of young career as a resident and has been a pleasure to work with him on. But I will let him talk more about it since it's kind of been his baby since the beginning.
I took an interest in it in residency. So I did a residency at Emory University. And that's when I think there was a lot more national adoption of TXA with arthroplasty. And so as I was going into a fellowship at University of Chicago for musculoskeletal oncology, I realized that there was no literature to speak of discussing it. So my end goal was, you know, to have a prospective randomized trial looking at TXA and endoprosthetic reconstruction. But before we could do that, we needed to establish that this was a viable thing. And so, you know, the first steps that we took were to take a retrospective study. And I met Dr. Hosse early in my career as he was our intern. And we collaborated kind of from the beginning on these tranexamic acid retrospective studies. And that's kind of where it all started.
So interesting. And just like you were saying, Dr. Sweeney, tranexamic acid has really kind of taken this increasing position and role in orthopedics over the last decade. And it's been really exciting to see all of the blood control and blood loss prevention that it's been able to provide. So bringing it into the orthopedic oncology world is extremely interesting. And not only seeing it from a financial standpoint, but also from a patient outcome standpoint. I think your paper did a phenomenal job kind of looking through this. And so Dr. Hosse, if you don't mind kind of going through with us a little bit about the paper and how you guys set it up, what you guys kind of looked at, some of the variables, just to give our readers and listeners an opportunity to kind of see how the paper was structured.
For sure. So I guess we'll go back one step just because this kind of stemmed initially from our blood loss paper, right? And we had talked about how it's, you know, in the last 10 to 15 years in orthopedics, really TXA has taken off. And like you mentioned, has, you know, shown wonderful results as far as decreasing blood loss. And really none of that had been translated over to the musculoskeletal oncology community, especially for people who are, you know, probably sicker at baseline and who are undergoing bigger surgeries than just a total hip arthroplasty. And so we initially did the blood loss study that showed, you know, amazing results where at 72 hours, these people were having decreased blood loss somewhere on the calculated order of about 700 milliliters on average. And then so to translate that to kind of a clinical role as far as how do we get this for people to buy on board, especially hospitals. And, you know, at some point, the almighty dollar is king. And so then we translated that into a cost analysis. And so we had this retrospective cohort where we looked at a cost analysis that was calculated in two ways. The first way was just simply looking at how much were we saving per patient simply from decreasing the amount of transfusions. And the second part of that then was taking it one step further. And we had seen that these people were leaving the hospital faster. And so we then added on to how much are we not only saving with decreased transfusions, but how much are we saving by decreasing the overall hospitalization of these patients. And that's where you really see the cost savings, at least in our cohort.
Absolutely. And anytime you see a decrease in hospital stay with just by adding in one variable is always kind of catches everybody's attention because we all know that that not only adds to cost, but also morbidity, mortality, even, especially in older groups in regards to kind of total joint replacements. Obviously, a lot of these patients, you have a breadth of age that you guys treat in the oncology world. And so that is definitely a big ear perk, if you will. And so as you guys are using TXA and started bringing that into the practice, I know when I first started using it in scoliosis cases, I could visually see a difference in the field. The blood was definitely more oozy, more watery in nature. And then we added the TXA and you could actually see more clots in front of us on the field. Could you see a difference in these type of procedures as you guys added in the TXA?
We weren't necessarily using it when I was in fellowship, but I adopted it pretty early as soon as I, you know, started my practice here at Kansas. And there's no question that, especially, you know, when you notice it the most is in these, and this is what spurred the study, was these big tumor resections doing a proximal femur or a distal femur, or even doing, you know, a large thigh soft tissue sarcoma, you know, something 20 centimeters or so, big tumor. And there's this, with big cases like this, there's just a similar to spine, there's just this constant ooze that's happening. And I think that's where we get the majority of our blood loss. It has nothing to do with getting into a blood vessel. It has everything to do with just the size of the surgery. And that is impacted pretty significantly by the TXA.
Absolutely. That ooze just definitely adds that toll. And so that makes such a difference. And so then as you guys were looking at this, I think it was phenomenal. You guys saw a decrease in upwards of over $5,000, almost $6,000 for some of these patients in terms of hospital cost reduction. Where do you think the biggest cost reduction was? Do you think it was blood loss or transfusion costs? Do you think it was holding back some of the costs associated with extended hospital stays? Where do you guys think the majority of the financial contributor was?
Yeah, Dr. Pierce, you hit the nail on the head there. We were seeing somewhere around $155 on average saving from just blood transfusion alone. But like you said, on average, $5,000 from decreased hospital stay. And you know, these people were leaving on average almost 2 days, it's like 1.9 days earlier, who had received transacetamic acid. And even when we kind of calculated for associated variables or, you know, did a regression analysis to look at potentially confounding variables, it was still significant. And so I think that's where you're seeing a lot of it. And then, so the question is, you know, what's allowing them to leave the hospital 2 days earlier? And, you know, that's kind of spurred some more research ideas in our head. Are these people walking faster and further? Obviously, they're having less blood transfusions, but something is certainly going on for there to be that significant of a reduction in postoperative hospitalization leading to decreased costs. And then, you know, you can talk about even down the line, if these people are leaving the hospital sooner, is that preventing complications, pneumonias, TVT, stuff like that from patients being in the hospital longer? But yeah, the majority of our cost reduction or the most profound cost reduction was from getting these people out of the hospital sooner.
That is very exciting. And just as you touched on, you know, as you're getting them out of the hospital, they move faster. So they're ambulating more. So the decreasing their DVT risks or decreasing pneumonia risks or decreasing bed sore risks, things like that, issues with their wounds. And so that kind of brings me into another question or component I had with using transacetamic acid in general. So it works to decrease blood loss and to increase kind of clotting. Have you seen it to be too good in that realm? Have you seen an increase in blood clots or venothrombotic events or anything like that? Dr. Sweeney, in your practice, have you seen that go too far on the spectrum, especially in cancer patients?
That was the big question the IRB had, and that was the big question that I had as well, you know, before getting into this. So, you know, before even starting this, we tried to look at the existing literature on high-risk patients, and there wasn't anything specific, at least in the English language literature, about the use of TXA in cancer patients. But there was a relatively large series that we found on using it in folks with pre-existing heart disease, history of DVT, you know, these sort of higher risk patients. And so we felt comfortable from that perspective in terms of using the TXA, knowing that other high risk groups had to some degree been vetted by the literature. And so we have had currently, I think, in our series, I we didn't find anything as far as increased incidence of DVT. We didn't see an increased incidence in obviously pulmonary embolism from that standpoint. And really the incidence overall has been very, very low. So to our knowledge, we don't think that there's any increased risk with the use of TXA in these higher risk populations. With that said, we still do screen to some degree. If somebody is actively on a blood thinner, we're not using, you know, TXA. I'm actually a little hesitant to use it in folks with a metastatic lung cancer. There was a study that came out about a year ago just showing, I think it was a 2 or 3-fold increase in DVT with patients having metastatic lung cancer as compared to, say, breast, thyroid, et cetera. So I think that there is still an element of patient selection where we have to be aware of.
That's perfect. And that was actually my next question. Who is the group that gets that? So that is extremely important whenever we're thinking about introducing new variables, especially medications. So, Dr. Hasse, when you are looking to start your career and you're learning everything you have from Dr. Sweeney and you've seen from this paper the use and benefit of TXA, where do you see yourself using this in your practice?
That's a great question. So, full disclosure, I'm not going into musculoskeletal oncology, but I think that doing all of this research based on transacetamic acid, especially in a high-risk population like we talked about these patients being, in my practice, I'm a full believer in it. I think that I'm going to use it for the majority of my cases that I'm doing any sort of bony fracture work. Any small difference that you can make for these patients whilst you're not really incurring much of an increased risk is huge. And I think that, you know, shifting towards improving outcomes in patient care has been a huge thing in orthopedics in the last 15 years. And getting people out of the hospital, getting people moving faster. And I think that this is a tool that we can use to help with that. And so, you know, in my career, I look forward to not only using it, but also doing future studies on my interests with the use of TXA and see how I can help the trauma patient population as well.
Is that your interest, trauma?
Yes, ma'am. Yep, I'm going to orthopedic traumatology.
Awesome. So I think trauma is an excellent overlap on where we've learned where TXA can help in our ortho-oncology patients with still having that increased DVT risk, but not seeing that risk when we use TXA. And blood loss is always important in trauma as well as with orthopedic oncology. And so that'll be a really nice bridge to see. And we look forward to seeing more work from you on this in the future. Dr. Sweeney, now that you have put this into practice for some time, and you have done these lovely papers kind of sharing this knowledge and this benefit with the orthopedic community, where else do you see yourself going with TXA? Is it just kind of, do you want to use it on every patient except for the ones that you mentioned? Or are you just reserving it for the larger dissection, larger procedure cases? Where do you see this going in the future?
I see it having a wider adoption for oncology. One of the things I do is I'm a member of the MORI board. That's the Musculoskeletal Oncology Research Initiative. It's basically like a young members group within the MSTS. And we are a collaborative research group. And what we actually have just gotten approval from Kansas, and we're on board at Allegheny with a prospective randomized controlled trial looking at two arms, really, endoprosthetic reconstruction. So that's both metastatic cancer as well as primary, as well as large soft tissue sarcomas located in the thigh and buttock. And so that's where I want to start. I think those are the biggest blood loss cases. And that randomized controlled trial would let us know a lot more about efficacy and safety than I think the retrospective will. From there, I mean, I honestly use it, you know, anytime I'm not able to use a tourniquet in a bony case for a large part. If I have, you know, a curettage of a pelvic tumor, or if I've got a retroperitoneal tumor that I'm going after, those are cases that I'm definitely using it.
That's fantastic. And with that, the prospective trial that you're talking about, what is the long range that you guys are going to watch those patients for in terms of looking at their complication rates or outcomes and things like that?
Right. So it luckily is relatively short. Reason being that the half-life, and Dr. Hasse may be able to help me with that. I can't remember the exact half-life of TXA, but it's fairly short. And so the DVT risk, it should be out of their system early. And the DVT risk should be relatively limited to early postoperative period. And so that's mostly what we're looking at. And we're going to follow them. The nice thing about oncology is we do have longitudinal follow-up with these folks as far as surveillance. And so we are able to extend that out. The actual study calls for following for 3 months following surgery in terms of documenting adverse outcomes around the surgery and around the use of TXA.
That'll be another very interesting study. I definitely can't wait to read as you guys come out with that and do that. And that is a benefit with the half-life being so short. And Dr. Hasse, do you know the half-life for TXA for us?
Yeah, it's somewhere between 2 and 11 hours based on different tissues. I think in joint fluid and whatnot, it's about 3 hours after the initial dose.
Perfect. That leads into another question too. Are you guys using this topically all the time? I know you guys mentioned topical use in the paper. Are you using it intravenous as a loading gram dose and then topical? Do you do a combination? And when do you use topical versus IV?
Right. So that's actually been something that's been developing since I started using it. What I initially would do is, you know, do a first dose as intravenous before the start of the case and then a topical at the end to try to limit some of the potential downsides of using it. But then as we start looking at the data and saying, well, there's not really any increased risk to the patients that we're identifying, I have converted to 1 gram at the start and then 1 gram at the finish. We haven't adopted, I know there's a bolus and then kind of a constant drip during the cases that is often used as well. I haven't really adopted that. For the prospective study that we did, I wanted to do the most, you know, commonly used. And so there was nothing scientific about finding out what the most common use was because there's no paper. It was me calling everybody I know to find out how they used it. And there's some variability, but it does seem that most people out there are using the 1 gram up front and 1 gram at close. And so that made it an easy thing. I was already doing that. And that made it something that could potentially attract people to being a part of the study.
Absolutely. Do you change that dose for any of your pediatric tumor patients? Do you do more of a weight-based version? And if so, what's your concoction?
I actually have not adopted it in pediatric patients yet. And I think a part of that was I just wasn't able to find anything in the literature in the same way that I found in the adult population telling me it was safe. So I have not extended that yet to the peds. With that said, I mean, if it's a 16-year-old, I have used it in that, like a 16, 17-year-old with an osteosarcoma, wide resection. I will use it in that. They've got a little bit more of an adult physiology, but the younger kids where I'd be doing weight-based, I have not tried that yet.
That'd be an interesting way to go too. Obviously, anytime we're looking at research studies in kids under 18, it's always a whole nother realm of paperwork and IRB and things like that as is appropriate. But it would definitely be interesting to kind of see. I know a lot of the scoliosis literature is done kind of just like you were talking about, starting with that loading dose. And then a lot of teams will use like a constant drip or kind of a basal dose throughout the procedure, but not really adding in that bolus at the end. Unlike a lot of the total joint literature that I have read shows more of, like you're saying, that 1 gram start, 1 gram at the end kind of bolus feature. So that might be interesting to kind of see along the road too, and what their outcomes and risk profile looks like, as well as their hospital stay decrease.
One thing that's interesting is that, you know, we talk about how safe the TXA is, and a lot of that is based off of, you know, recent literature, but, you know, there are documented cases of TXA toxicity. It's mainly in kind of cardiothoracic literature that I saw that, but it was with, and I can't remember the exact doses at this point, but it was with higher loading doses. It was with higher overall doses during the case. And that's one of the reasons too, that I kind of shied a little bit away from that, was because, you know, in a healthy population, the only negative effects that I found in the literature were based on these higher doses. And so for a cancer population, I thought it would be more prudent to use more of the arthroplasty way of doing it with the 1 gram, 1 gram.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think that is the other comment to really focus on, is what is the downfall? You know, it seems overall fairly safe, but when it is not safe, what does that look like? What are some, you said some cardiotoxicity?
It was clotting was the issues, but it was in cardiothoracic cases. Oral surgeons and cardiothoracic surgeons were really the first early adopters of this medication. We're kind of coming a little late to the game.
Very interesting. It's amazing what we can learn from our colleagues.
You know, there's some more recent spine literature coming out looking at pretty high doses that are being redosed multiple times during long fusion surgeries. And at least the literature that's been out there seems to be safe at much higher doses than the joints have been using. I think it's going to be kind of finding a sweet spot over the next few years of, you know, what is the optimal dosage that's safe, but kind of provides the most blood loss reduction. And so I think there's still a lot of change that will not only go on within musculoskeletal oncology literature, but just tranexamic acid literature in and of itself.
Absolutely. It makes a lot of sense, just the entirety or the total dose that the patient is seeing having the biggest effect. And so I don't blame you, Dr. Sweeney. I think I would have probably done the same thing with keeping it, especially in that higher risk population of our oncologic patients, of really keeping that 1 gram bolus, 1 gram bolus. Because the other thing is a lot of times those cases take a while, which is appropriate. There's a lot of meticulous dissection, and there's a lot of preparing the tissue bed and then all of the reconstruction. And so to have a basal rate going and running the whole time, it can be a significant amount in total at the end of the case. So that makes a lot of sense.
In our actual study, it wasn't always 1 gram up front, 1 gram at the end, because this was retrospective. And so it did encompass a lot of different methods of use. So I just realized, because we were kind of talking about that, I don't know if we need to clarify that or not.
I was reading it was mostly topical. You guys also doing the bolus dose and topical at the end?
So this was also three different surgeons doing their preferences. So I know my partner, Howard Rosenthal, was using mostly topical because he was worried about the clotting impact of using IV, whereas I was doing the hybrid IV topical at first and then converted over to IV. And then Dr. Rosenthal is my senior partner, so naturally there were more cases because we're doing a retrospective analysis that were his. So we were lucky in that, because I had thought to be using it beforehand. And when I came here, he was already starting to adopt it.
It's interesting to see, even with the variation in the surgeon preference on the dosing of and the timing and the route, there still was a positive increase in outcome for your patients to just have TXA in general, and that decrease in costs and decrease in hospital stay. So it definitely will be interesting as you guys come out with that prospective trial with a more solidified route and dose to see if it truly makes a significant difference. But overall, seeing the TXA come through, it seems to be very positive for this group.
One of the most interesting things that I think came out of the study was based on our sex-based analysis. But essentially, you know, we did a sex-based analysis within our cohort here. We found some pretty interesting results. Basically, both female and male patients in the TXA cohort experienced significantly decreased cost overall, but the cost savings for females was significantly less. And this was both seen for blood transfusions and postoperative hospital stay, meaning the kind of effectiveness at decreasing blood transfusions and the effectiveness at decreasing postoperative hospitalizations in females was significantly less than in males. And I think that that is an important thing to kind of suss out in the literature going forward. There was one previous study looking at TXA in just total joint arthroplasty from 2018 that did find females were more likely than male counterparts to still require transfusions with TXA use. And so I think that's an interesting part of the study and something that gets overshadowed a little bit or not looked at as much in the literature, but something to look at going forward as the research on transacemic acid continues to evolve.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I did notice that in the paper. I thought that was interesting to look at that sex and gender difference with the results. Do you think that is because overall the females needed less blood transfusion in both groups? Or do you think that there is some other kind of physiologic difference that makes that impact less for females or more impactful for the male group?
That's a great question. And I don't know that we know the answer to that. And I don't know that our paper did a great job at identifying that the females who got TXA still required a higher number of transfusions. So I think it was the effectiveness of TXA that we saw with their use, decreasing, can't speak to blood loss, but at least decreasing the necessity of transfusions. That was a big factor. They also, on average, stayed slightly longer than males who received transacemic acid.
Interesting. Could be a lot of different variables that play into that, but it's definitely a very interesting thing to see if we can get more details pursed out in the future. I agree.
Now, I think one of the big things is everyone, at least I had several comments from other residents and staff that they think transacemic acid is an expensive drug, and it's actually quite cheap. You know, at our institution, just what the cost of procurement is for our hospital is $55 per patient. So it's not this several thousand dollar drug that we're giving these people each surgery. It's actually quite cheap. And I think most places will find that they can probably even get it cheaper than that. So that is something I think to keep in mind, you know, outside of the kind of efficacy and everything of decreasing blood losses, is you're not adding a whole lot of cost expense.
Makes a big difference.
There's not a whole lot of easy wins in orthopedics, and I feel like this is one of them when you look at just the cost, the safety, and the efficacy of it.
I agree. An easy win is one to not ignore, for sure. We need to take them when we can get them, especially nowadays. Well, wonderful. Thank you guys so much for all of your time and your insights, your expertise. This has been a very interesting interview and chat about the world of TXA and both the orthopedic oncological patient cohort, as well as in orthopedic patients and all medical patients. So I look forward to more work from the both of you on this and so grateful for your time today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Well, this concludes another episode of JOS Unplugged. We appreciate you joining us this month. To all of the future orthopedic surgeons engaging in the interview trail this year, good luck. And to all of the programs and mentors, good luck to you as well. Next month, we will review the use of adjunct antiseptic agents in periprosthetic joint infections. We'll also delve into the effect of operating room size on orthopedic surgical site infection rates. And finally, delve into further deep gluteal pain in orthopedics, a challenging diagnosis. We look forward to you joining us next month. We'll see you soon.